Okay, welcome listeners to the inaugural Zoom and JD interview. I'm very excited to introduce the very first guest of the show. The man, the myth, the legend, Loomdart himself. Loomdart, how are you going?
I'm not too bad, mate. How are you?
I'm very, very well, thanks. Very excited to get the show on the road.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we get into things, I guess I'll just give a little intro of what I'm trying to do here, and then I'll let you introduce yourself. I've kind of amassed a nice little collection of contacts, both in the trading space and crypto business space, and I think it'd be interesting to interview them, to kind of know the people behind the crypto Twitter accounts, the people behind the businesses that make our industry tick. And obviously, you're a very good friend of mine. One of the best traders I know, so I think you're the best person to kick this off.
Ah, how nice.
Maybe, tell us, you know, how you got into trading, you know, how early you started trading, and I think a question that a lot of people would like to know is, why Loomdart? What does Loomdart mean?
Ooh, well, I'll start off with how I got into trading. So, I think there's many people like me who we all got in through Dogecoin, just browsing Reddit one day, and then you're like, oh, what's this doggy coin thing? And then, well, I bought a few Dogecoin back when it was like just launched, and then that went up 10 times. And I was like, whoa.
Are you really serious? Your first coin was Dogecoin?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I just went on the Reddit, and everyone seemed so happy, so I was like, all right, I'll buy some of this. It's the worst that could happen. So that initial investment went up 10x post the NASCAR thing they had where they sponsored a car.
Right, classic.
And then I was like, whoa, I'm an entrepreneur. So I 10 times my initial investment and then decided to buy 10 times that through Reddit. There was a Reddit subreddit called r/DogeMarkets where you could buy Dogecoin through... Okay. You could buy it from people through PayPal.
Right. Honestly, man, it sounds like a parody interview already. You're telling me... Because I know like of ETH Markets and BTC Markets subreddits, and you're telling me there's a Doge Markets subreddit, and that's literally where you first started.
Yeah, well, it gets better because since you're buying through PayPal, there's obviously going to be some type of premium. And I bought at the exact top of the Wolong pump where Doge was trading about 300 Satoshis. And I paid about a 30% premium on that.
Just from some random PayPal account?
Yeah, just some random dude. Although he had a nice little website set up where you'd select how much Doge you wanted and then the whole PayPal pay here box would show up.
Right. So... if Dogecoin hadn't pumped 10 times after you bought it, do you think you would have stayed in crypto?
That's a cool...
Or is it, that was kind of like the first hit that hooked you in?
I reckon it would have probably taken me quite some time to kind of re-find crypto.
Right.
If Doge hadn't done what it did.
Yeah. And had you traded other markets before crypto, or was crypto your first... your first kind of trade?
Crypto was my first.
Yeah, sweet. And then you hop onto Twitter and become infamous. Why Loomdart? What does this mean?
Ooh, so do you know that film Wanted where there's I can't remember his name, but Angelina Jolie's in it and like you can bend bullets.
Oh right, yeah. Classic.
There's like a big part of that film is the whole pardon me, is the loom where they kind of... it's where they write in the encoded messages. And I was just thinking one day, like, wow, I really need a new username. So I just thought of that loom. And then I was like, well, markets, precision, you know.
Right.
Darts are precise.
Right.
So I just put the two words together and thought of Loomdart.
And the rest is history. And then how quickly after creating the account did you coin the term loom lines?
So...
infamously.
So this was initially, it was just like I've been posting high time frame trend lines for years now. I have charts and trading view back from like 2014, where it was just some diagonal lines going straight down, because that's what Bitcoin was doing as it tumbled. But I think late 2019, where we had the whole 14k blow off top, my trend line started getting a bit more popular. And as always, with popularity comes the parodies,
right?
And the gifs of cats with lasers.
Yes.
And then, like, someone started memeing them as loom lions. And then I kind of did it in like a ironic way.
Right, right. So this was a genuine community thing. You didn't come up with this yourself.
No.
The term. Right.
I'm not that decrepit.
Do you think of yourself as someone who informs their trades with TA, or are you more of a value investor?
I think that's a very good question, John. I think that so I think trend lines definitely have a role, but it's like the TA can be whatever you want it to be. So you can make a bullish chart look bearish if you're fundamentally bearish because of some underlying market metrics.
Right.
And I think I kind of use TA as a way to show my, say if I'm bullish Bitcoin because of some, well, because the price went down 70% and everyone got liquidated. I mean, maybe the TA someone else sees might not show that as being bullish, but I think if I'm looking for a bullish sign, my
I think I can understand what you mean. I think one reason I've often liked talking to you about your thoughts with trading is I'm definitely not someone that relies on TA myself. I tend to trade a lot longer time frames, and I look for, I think of a value investing type thing. I want to know the details of the coin and the team, and even, you know, more kind of dodgy crypto value things, which are like, how much money do they have and are they burning it really quickly? Do they have a bad reputation? Stuff that doesn't really matter in the traditional finance space. But all the TA I've published ever has been a joke. But privately, I might chart a few lines, and it's kind of like, these are the options of where it could go. You know, if it goes up, this is how it'll go up. And if it goes down, this is how it'll go down. But whether it goes up or down isn't based on where the chart came from. I'm not one of those TA god people who thinks that, you know,
news is priced into the chart.
Right,
it was all apparent beforehand.
Yeah, yeah. And I know a lot of TA people aren't like that, but there seems to be a lot of people in the crypto space especially who sell themselves like that, because there's a lot of people who have no idea what they're doing.
I think the main, like, reason behind that is humans are very... we're very inclined to find patterns in everything, and, like, we inherently can't stand chaos. So any way to explain anything, or, like, some way to find a pattern that might have some semblance of predicting stuff, people will instantly gravitate towards, just because the human brain kind of,
it's
when
attractive.
We feel like there's chaos, like we're out of control, it's very bad for the psyche, and it makes you start being a much more like conspiratory.
Right,
that you just start believing stuff that really isn't true. Like, say if the price dumped 70% and then pumped 200% in like a day, and some guy, maybe if it wasn't so major, you wouldn't have believed this man's Elliott wave hypothesis as to why it moved.
Sure.
But you see it and you're like, oh, I have no idea what's going on. And then you see some guy post a chart of like, this was just a B wave retracement onto a C.
Yeah.
And then you'd be like, wow, maybe this does work.
Yeah, I've seen some people who will have a chart for 6 months or a year, and it just has a band or something. And the band is so huge that the probability of the coin staying in that range is really, really high. But then they'll fall in love with their chart and think that they've figured out something really amazing. So yeah, I think that thesis makes sense, especially in crypto where the markets are extremely chaotic. That could explain why there's a higher than usual interest in TA and charting and whatever. But given you brought up, you know, 70% moves, I think 2020 has been, it's like nostalgic for me. I feel like the old crypto's back. And just as I was starting to get bored and starting to question if those days of absolutely insane one-day moves of up to 50% or this, even beyond.
March, was it March 13 or March 12th?
It was,
I guess it's
it depends on the country you're in. I remember hearing a lot of people calling it Friday 13th, which is a very spooky day to have the markets crash.
Well, I guess the day when Bitcoin just completely died. I mean, being that bad.
Well, okay.
I mean, percent-wise, open interest-wise, just cataclysm.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, man. Because I remember, we don't have to go into too much detail here, man, but you were hit pretty hard on that day. And I was really surprised because I got really, really excited when I saw that volatility. I was just like, the old crypto is back. Money's to be made. Money's to be lost. There's going to be blood. There's also going to be a lot of, you know, new people who are going to get rich off this if they can be ballsy and whatever. And I was hitting up kind of OG traders and whatever. And I was surprised how many people, you know, yourself and a few other guys were really, really hit hard and just didn't see it coming at all. Like, no offense, man. It's just...
Oh, that's fine.
Like, there was so much...
Recovered.
There was so much moving in the traditional markets and so much crazy shit was going on. I'm like, come on, if there was going to be a crazy move, it was going to be around that time. But so many people got caught out.
I think what happened is the fact that kind of... We were at 10K and then we just started bleeding downwards. And I think... A lot of people, me included, got caught in underwater long positions. But the issue here is we fell into the 6K range, which has historically been the most, well, the best Bitcoin support there's ever been, 6K. Sure. And so it kind of became like, well, I think, not really for me, but I think for most of the people who got just completely decimated, is why would you close your long at the greatest support level?
Right.
And then as 6K fell, the so index price is the XP to USD index, right?
On BitMEX?
Yeah.
It's called the BXBT, yeah.
BXBT. And then, so the you get liquidated off of Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, and can you explain what Mark price is?
Right, so Mark price, on the XBT USD swap, it's mostly tied to the index price. So it just factors in the current funding rate as well, but it's pretty much within, it's usually going to be within a few dollars of the BXBT index price, yeah. So even if the swap runs away $100, $200 from the index, the liquidations are still going to be based on the index price. And I think actually on the 13th, crazy day, that happened, yeah. The index was like over $100 out of whack at sometimes. Oh, not the
it
index,
was,
sorry.
It was 600.
The really?
Price was at 44 and the index was at 5K, yeah.
Okay. That's really crazy. The worst I saw it when I was ever like looking at the website was close to 200. Yeah. That's
oh,
unreal,
no, it went
man.
Really bad. That's kind of what I think cemented the death prediction of that day, because in crypto you get these very rare opportunities where it makes sense to go 100x.
Yeah.
Because, say, the index price... okay, so the last price is the price on the order book of BitMEX. So, say the index is at 5K, but the last price, which is the actual price on BitMEX, is at 4,400.
Right.
If you 100x long, your liquidation price...
Yeah. Yeah, you're...
...is based off of Mark, not
exactly.
Index. Your liquidation price is based off of Mark, so you get liquidated when the price drops 1% from 4,400.
Yeah,
but that's when the index price drops.
This is a really great point. It's free money in the sense that you can open a huge position and actually your chance of liquidation is extremely small.
Yeah, so people figured this out, and since it's such a like situations like this very very rarely ever arise.
These days,
you had
at least,
a
yeah.
huge swath of people just degen longing because their liquidations were so far away.
Well, the other really important point is that the same reason that you can open up a leveraged long when the Mark price is out of whack or out of sync with the trading price of the swap, it also makes it really hard to short. If the swap is $400 below the Mark price, if you try to open a short position, you're going to be liquidated based on that Mark price, which is $400 higher than the price you're trying to open at. Essentially, if you buy that, there's going to be no sell pressure unless people are on very low leverage. Yeah, it's a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah, well, the issue was that I think too many people realized it was a free money situation.
Mm.
And the issue is they couldn't close those positions. They had to be liquidated.
Right, so right, I understand.
This imbalance started happening at, I'd say, mid-fives, where the last price and the mark price started diverging.
Yeah.
And so since there wasn't much buy liquidity on BitMEX, the second the first one of these guys started getting liquidated, it just continued the free rolling liquidations that were just smashing the price down over and over and over.
Yeah.
And each level someone would 100x long with like just a bunch of money hoping for the free money rolled. And then the price would keep going down and they'd get liquidated and their liquidation would just destroy the books.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it kind of just a huge snowball.
It is an interesting idea. It would be cool to see taker buys that were happening as the price was falling, because that would kind of validate whether what you're saying is correct. I haven't heard this hypothesis before, but to be honest, that makes a lot of sense, man. But you should be able to verify this with public data to a degree, to see if people were, you know, getting in these longs.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I mean, I speak from personal experience, because I was.
Yeah, man.
I mean, I was, at 7K, I was depressed. At 6, it was just like, wow. 5, it was very, very sad. At 4, I was just like, wow. I just started laughing, and at 3, I was euphoric. Oh, it was, I processed all the sadness.
Right, I think that's when I was messaging you, man. You were really all over the place. I think the other thing that surprised me was a lot of really big traders were in leverage positions, really leverage positions. But given what you're saying, I guess that might have been, it's not that they had a big position, a big leverage position at the start of the dump. It's that as the dump was occurring, if you've been buying what you thought are big dips in the past, you know, if the price dips like 10-15%, you just know to buy that, add to your long, it's like the price will recover. And then it didn't. I understand now why people ended up in these crazy, crazy long positions, very underwater or getting liquidated. People who like never get liquidated.
It was an incredibly nasty move. So going back to the point where like emotions, I think at 3K it kind of dawned on me where like historically, whenever Bitcoin's done something just completely insane to one side, it will always do the reverse. And it was pretty clear that this move down was just going to, it destroyed everyone.
Yeah.
So there was no one left long Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Which obviously, as we know, tends to happen in Bitcoin's case and did happen this time. We just rallied straight back to 10K.
Right, right.
Oh, I love it.
And you've been trading this, you know, pretty hardcore. I hope it's okay to say, I remember I asked you a couple of weeks ago if you could do the podcast and you told me that you hadn't showered in 4 days and had only slept every two or something like that. been absolutely smashing it, man, which is really, really cool to see. I mean, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, not just getting cut really hard, but what are some of the best trades or like trading periods you've had? Has the past couple of months, would you put that in that category?
I mean, I've never traded better than I have these last few months.
So
I think
gangster.
I'd like to talk a bit about this. It's just, I think whenever there's a major move, just like something completely insane, like say us dumping from 14,000 to, I think, 10,000?
Yeah.
In like a few days. Something like that, it triggers a switch in the market where it becomes much more, I think, much more volatile, but volatile in a kind of controllable, manageable way, where like TA starts working much, much better and everything just becomes a lot more defined. So say sometimes the price is really choppy and you're just trying to get like some nice small trades in and you just can't. But there's the second like a huge amount of volatility occurs. It's like everyone comes to the battle stations and they just start drawing the most basic TA, which means since there's so many eyes looking at it, the most basic TA works.
Yeah.
And it just becomes a money printer as long as like you're kind of sensible. I think the fact that suddenly Paul Tudor Jones has come out as being bullish Bitcoin,
yeah,
is kind of, I expect, like, he probably didn't buy the bottom, but I'm assuming he bought, like, he's in decent profit now.
Yeah. Another interesting thing about that, I think this whole economic shutdown and the chaos in traditional markets and then the immediate money printing from the Fed and the wide public support that has, it's kind of vindicated a lot of the crazier crypto personalities and ideas that people have, if that makes sense. As in,
I think it's too early to say, really.
Because I've got some exposure talking to people who are only in traditional markets or work for funds who, you know, illegally can't touch crypto, or they see it as too risky. And when you say things like this Fed money printing stuff is insane, or traditional markets are a lot more vulnerable than you think, and it's a fragile system and whatever. And a lot of these guys, because times have been so good pretty much since the global financial crisis in the last decade, these guys have become kind of lazy, and I think it was easy for them to dismiss the crypto type of person. I think that people are really starting to think outside the square now because of the situation we're in, and I think that's why you're seeing people who you wouldn't expect to talk highly or normally about Bitcoin are suddenly doing that.
I think, yeah, I get what you mean. Even if the whole inflation thing, like, isn't valid, I mean, I can't say if it is or it isn't, it's just not my field. But I think just the thought in people's heads is enough.
Mm.
And as you said, it's still a time of prosperity for the richer people who don't have jobs to be fired from.
Yeah.
And they have, obviously, they have lots of capital. And I think the whole, if Europe, PTJ's level, where you allocate maybe say 1 or 2%, is a very good start, where it's kind of like a just safety of mind thing.
Yeah,
where before you never really knew about Bitcoin, you thought it may have been a scam, but like it's still kept around, it's still worth quite a bit of money, so you're like, I mean, what's the worst that can happen? I'll put 1 or 2% in and just, it would be like a
serious mind thing. It's kind of like, I think maybe in the past, if you propose to someone who's running a fund, like, put 1 or 2% into crypto, it's a small part of your portfolio, but it's a great hedge or something against insane things happening or further digitization of currency in general. And I guess in the past, people, you know, when you talk to these people, a lot of them would say, I don't know if Bitcoin's going to be around in a year or two, but I don't think people say that anymore. I think they definitely think Bitcoin's going to be around. It is now the topic is, what's the price going to be?
That's a very good point.
Mm.
I feel like I really agree with that.
It's good times, man. I personally am feeling more bullish than I have in a long time. But I'm a permabull by heart. I've been holding crypto for years and years and years. But I'm super, super excited to see how Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general fits into this new picture, because my theory is that we're seeing all these new economic policies tried, or situations that we haven't been in for decades arise, you know, economic shutdowns, money printing, all these kind of cash injections into things, handouts, and I don't think the economy is necessarily ever going to be the same. I don't think there's going to be like a revolution or anything, but people are open-minded right now when it comes to thinking about money and the economy in a way they haven't been in a long time. And if cryptocurrency doesn't come into the conversation here and isn't taken seriously, then honestly, I'll start to revisit my bullish case that I've had, you know, for the past 8 years.
That seems valid. I mean, just the fact that the whole money printer go burr thing is like a viral meme is enough, I think. Just people having that in their mind.
You know, that's kind of what I was saying before, though, man. If you think about Bitcoin, people have been making fun of the idea of money printing and QE for years. But everyday people and people in banks wouldn't really talk about it like that. But now they're making the memes. They're making memes about the stuff we've been talking about for years. And that means that they kind of have to revisit the stuff we've been talking about and go like, maybe these guys are right. Maybe these guys have a point. And also, they're going to go, some of the stuff we say is still batshit crazy, and it will always be that way. But I think there's this beautiful blend of kind of fiction and entertainment value in crypto, but there's this very big truth in there about economics and money in the digital world that is trying to get out through all the weird memes and dramas.
As you said before, the digitalization of money.
Mm.
I think China is probably going to be the most important case in this regard with DCEP.
Yeah.
Where I think it's going to be a bigger thing than most in the West think it will be for the Chinese economy and stuff.
I think people in general, when you look at China, I always find it interesting how many everyday people in Western countries, when you hear about the kind of technology that's already used in China, they get really surprised about how technologically advanced China is. I think that with digital currency, they will show the West some interesting things that we hadn't thought of before in the same way. Okay, so let's chat DeFi a little bit. What do you think about DeFi?
I really like the aspect of DeFi where you can, like, decentralized options.
Mm.
I think it's all really cool stuff. It's just, they're kind of scratching their right ear with their left hand.
Hmm.
With the whole introduction of stable coins that aren't actually stable coins. I mean, it would be infinitely easier for the whole DeFi ecosystem if they just used centralized stable coins like Tether.
So what's the problem with something like DAI then?
I think it's just, you can never inherently trust a system like DAI. Because the risk is all algorithmic,
right?
Like it's all
code.
There's a lot of risk in the system itself, and I think the point of DeFi, it's not to stop, like, the risk of USDT being shut down is not the same as why it's not the same risk that causes people to use DeFi. DeFi is meant to be a platform for the unbanked, right? But yeah. Like, the risk an unbanked person has is not the same risk Tether has. So I think people not using Tether for DeFi because it's centralized is kind of missing the point. Because it's centralized to a different kind of entity.
But don't you think... So you're more interested in, like, DYDX type stuff? You know, that exchange?
Yeah, I think, like, there's a market for things like that.
But that's interesting because I'll be honest, I don't have that much knowledge about how these things work under the hood. The reason why I feel a lot of respect for the DeFi community is, personally, I know a few guys, like crypto OG people, who have been working in that space, you know, before it was a buzzword. And they're some of the better minds, I guess, and I'm really impressed with the work they're doing. I feel like all the people who were busy actually working on shit during the ICO scam period, they moved into DeFi and now they're building really cool stuff. And I think there's a good balance between the kind of crypto philosophy of decentralizing and whatever, and actually quality products that work, making sure these are things that people are actually going to use and are very polished, and also not being over the top philosophical about it. Just build something great and show that there's use case.
I'd agree with that. I really think they're crippling themselves.
But see, I actually feel the opposite way, man. Like, I'm more interested in stuff like DAI than the exchanges, because I feel like the exchanges are, they just don't provide enough value over a centralized exchange. But maybe I'm missing something.
I like the exchanges, and it allows you to kind of, well, I like the concept of exchanges in the future. Not currently, but where you could, say, hedge your currency. So say you're in euros and you want exposure to dollars.
Right.
Just a way to synthetically create a product that can hedge you.
Sure. Right.
I think stuff like that's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I get what you mean about the whole, I think DAI in its essence is, it's kind of like a crypto fantasy dream where it's like this amazing thing that's pegged to a dollar, but it doesn't have any dollar exposure or stuff. But I think it's kind of a bit too far. Where, like, it's a bit too into the mystical realm.
I'm not sure if you know how well it works either. And to be honest, maybe I'm giving something too much credit given how little I understand about it. But you have to really over-collateralize if you want die, right? Like, you have to lock up.
Last time I remember, it was like 140%. Like, when you have such a nice alternative that's proven and used by millions of people like Teva, it just seems bizarre.
Sure. Yeah, interesting. I really want to know what you think of Aussie Satoshi. Because I just find him so interesting as an Australian, because he's just this impossible character. I don't know any other person that's like him in Australia. It's just a very strange person. I don't know how he was invented. But yeah, what do you think?
When you role play a fantasy for so long, it's like, say you say a little white lie now and then, just like a bunch of friends, and then eventually you'll start believing it yourself as truth.
Right.
So, like, I think Mr. Wright has taken that to a whole new level where he's invented an entire new world, and he's he's talked about it so much and done so many emotional conferences and talks that he's bought into it himself. He knows it's not true, but he also mentally knows that he's right.
He's invested himself too far.
Yeah, I think that's...
can't let go.
I think that's a big case of that. But, I mean, it's for BSV, it's worked, I'd say.
Man,
it's still around and it's still got a huge...
This coin is like an unflushable turd, man. Do you have any?
I don't, but I'd like to talk about that a bit.
Sure, yeah.
See, BSV really benefits from the fact that it's a Bitcoin Cash fork, not a Bitcoin fork.
Okay.
So it's kind of like it's a branch of a branch where the amount of actual BSV in circulation is, well, it's got to be lower than the amount of Bitcoin Cash in circulation, because you needed Bitcoin Cash to get BSV. And so I think it's much lower than people think. So probably only like a few million compared to the 15 million Bitcoin out there.
Maybe this is a stupid question, but maybe some people who'll be listening will be in a similar situation. So as far as the mining reward, it's still kind of, there's new supply coming in at the same rate as Bitcoin Cash, right?
Yeah.
But you're specifically saying the existing amount before the fork, or the amount of Satoshi Vision coins, is lower because of all that coins that are locked up at the beginning that aren't released necessarily. Right.
Because you had to unlock your Bitcoin Cash to get your Bitcoin Cash SV.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about it like that. Do you think when you see the coin listed on things like CMC and you see the total in circulation, that it's probably it's overestimating the actual amount?
Oh, it's completely... Well, let me check what it is right now.
That's a really good point, man.
Yeah, so it says the circulating supply is 18.4 million.
Right.
Which is just completely not true.
See, this is exactly the kind of stuff I love from you, man. I was saying earlier in this interview that I love looking at things from this value investing point of view. And this is the kind of insight that if you realize that about a coin, you can really have an edge on understanding how this coin's going to move. A lot of people wouldn't have made that connection. It's kind of an obvious one, really. But a lot of people, myself included, have never considered this.
Yeah, I mean, it just gives them a free way. It's like a leveraged position on their coin market cap rank.
Yeah.
Since, say, they pump it, well, say the price increases by 10%, you've suddenly got a 10% increase on 18.4 million coins when the actual increase is on much less coins.
Right.
It just looks good.
Right. That's a really good point. So that helps them get a better ranking in CMC. Damn.
I think I kind of respect the BSV guys' hustle in that they understood that there's like a group of people who are like, whoa, this Bitcoin, this blockchain tech is so amazing.
Right.
But the thing is, like, blockchain comes with trade-offs where it's decentralized, but you can't really do much upon it because of the resource intensiveness of a decentralized network. But BSV's kind of skirted that. It's basically centralized in that the amount of resources you need to process it are very high.
Right.
But they just gloss over that and say, well, I mean, it's still a blockchain. And because the block sizes are so high, you can do quite a lot on the BSV blockchain.
Right.
To the point where they've actually, they have some decent developers working on it.
Interesting. So,
and so these guys can do like just crazy stuff that you obviously can't do on any other blockchain just because the size limitations and stuff are in place.
Okay. Interesting.
And suddenly you get BSV, which you can show as this huge innovative, like, look at all this stuff we're doing on the blockchain, come invest with us. We're going to be like the big one.
Okay, there's kind of a wider question here then. You've been in crypto for how many years now? Seven years,
2014
8 years?
2014 was when
six years.
6 years, yeah.
Right. And obviously over the time, the culture has, some things have changed, some things have stayed the same. I'm just curious, how much do you think about the culture in the space? How much does it matter to you? Do you have hopes for it changing in some way, or how do you think it factors into how coins perform? And
well, I mean, in 2014, all the true Bitcoin believers were anonymous, and
yeah,
they kept their insane ideas to themselves. But then suddenly it became popular to have a Twitter account.
Yeah.
And you had this influx of just completely just batshit insane people pop up and just
right.
kind of... If you're in the, I don't want to use a Bitcoin maximalist circle because, like, you can be a sensible maximalist. I don't think attributing something negative to that moniker is a good idea. But
I'm happy to admit, for me, being a Bitcoin maximalist, honestly, man, my thesis on that is, I know I can trust Bitcoin. I've held it for a long time. I know how it works. I'm interested in it, and I don't have the time or energy to go through and vet all these other coins, 99% of which are complete rubbish. There is gold in there, but I really admire you for, you just constantly trawl through all of this rubbish. I can't be bothered doing it. So I'm someone who goes, I'm just going to be in the Bitcoin crowd, and I'm happy to do that. And then I'll just wait for people like you to send me interesting links and things. And I'll take a side
I meant
interest.
It as in like a kind of the whole... They're not so maximalist as in like the detestment of non-Bitcoin cryptos.
Right.
But in the kind of their economic views.
Okay.
And what they kind of expect to happen.
Right, okay. With the Twitter thing, I think what you said is very funny, that before crypto Twitter, there were all these crazy anonymous people in crypto, but they kind of kept their crazy ideas to themselves. I think for me, the interesting thing about crypto Twitter is that I think it emboldened all these crazy people. I know it did for me.
That's a very good point.
My first crypto Twitter account was literally called Crazy John. I don't know if you remember that.
And
I get
John,
it.
Yeah.
I get in arguments with people, and then if someone was getting upset, someone would come in and be like, "Dude, his name is literally Crazy John. You don't need to have an argue about mainstream economics with this guy." But on crypto Twitter, you found these people who have these similar interests and think about the world in similar ways and like finding patterns and like trying to find these little nooks and crannies that haven't been discovered yet and talking about them like lunatics. I think before crypto Twitter, a lot of people who, they were kind of interested in crypto, but they weren't sure what other kind of people were interested or whether they were alone in their crazy ideas.
I think most of it was forum driven then, where you'd kind of... It's not an echo chamber per se, because I think that the whole concept of echo chambers is just a bit unwarranted. But it's you're amongst people like yourself, whereas on Twitter, obviously, it's one platform.
Yeah.
So you got a mix of everyone.
Yeah.
And that's good and bad, and it kind of creates like an us versus them mentality.
What do you think of the J.K. Rowling tweet? Did you reply?
Which one?
The Harry Potter lady. She tweeted...
Oh, I think she was just having fun one night drinking a bit and just thought, you know, I'll just have some fun with like a group of people. Those Bitcoin guys are a bit crazy.
It's pretty funny because then... every second crypto Twitter account seemed to have replied to that tweet by the end of the night. It was very funny to watch.
Nah, I think it was a fun little experiment on her behalf.
Yeah, but it was funny.
I mean, I can't really like pay any like actual... mind or heed to it though. I think it was just all in fun.
Oh, yeah. Right. I just mean it was kind of an interesting example of the crypto Twitter can be its own little bubble. And then that kind of got injected and got everyone excited. And then you see some people trying to explain Bitcoin in a tweet and whatever, who usually have these crazy accounts, and suddenly they're like trying to be a gentleman or something. And it's like, dude, what are you doing?
The one issue with stuff like that happening is you get people who kind of, they'll read through the 1,000 or so replies and then pick 5 that kind of conforms to their, I either don't like these people or do like these people and here's why. Mm. And when you have like 1,000 people replying, you can basically find anything you want to kind of make a bias and then write a news article about that perhaps isn't true.
Yeah. I actually, one thing I'd say about the culture over time is it's been a really hard slog, but, and maybe a lot of people would disagree with me, but having the benefit of being in this space for a long time, I really feel like people are generally more honest these days than they used to be when they talk about exchanges and products and things like that. I don't think there's as much blatant lying and rubbish and dodgy kind of weird marketing technique stuff that goes on.
I think I'd agree with that.
I think it kind of peaked with the whole ICO bubble thing. I think people are too smart now. Like, they became a lot more skeptical. People are a lot more cautious, and I think that's good. I think it's a lot better.
Yeah, I'd agree. On the topic of like exchanges, I think the one caveat is, are the people we see on Twitter aren't really... Twitter, for part of crypto, is one of probably the more advanced civilizations. Where, like, say you go onto crypto YouTube.
Yeah.
And it's just a complete hellhole with people shilling these exchanges.
That's a good point.
Just, like, appeared out of nowhere. Mm. We get mostly the good stuff on Twitter.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hopefully this show, which will be uploaded to YouTube, will start to, you know, break some ground, start cleaning the space up. Steal all these scam sources. Yeah. But there hasn't been, I can't think of any recent outright scam coins that are having, you know, massive presentations and getting mainstream press and a lot of credibility, I guess.
Yeah, you're right.
Mm.
I think there's not many scam coins just because there's not much money to be made there.
Yeah.
But something I'd say is, like, there hasn't been any major scam exchanges either, which is decent, I'd say.
To be honest, I think we've spoken about this a little bit, but I remember when Bybit came out, I was so convinced that they were a scam. And I went around telling everyone, you just wait, this is going to be some old school scam stuff where they're giving out all these deposit bonuses. It's really hard to find information about the team online. You just wait, they're going to get all these deposits and do the classic run, like just grab and run. And I've been proven wrong. They seem to be a legit exchange. I don't know if you trade on Bybit.
I've traded on basically every derivatives exchange. Bybit, I didn't really mind Bybit. I mean, the UI is nice. And I had an issue once where I had a position that wasn't updating on the website. So I had to hit refresh and then the position updated so that I could buy and sell into the position and it wouldn't update.
Okay.
But I told them about it, and within a week they'd like fixed it.
Yeah,
I think like a pretty big bonus.
I feel bad now that I went around.
I think the whole that's not a bad approach in that you get others to vet it for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can be like, all right, this maybe isn't that bad, and they've gone past the grace period.
Yeah, I think as well. I just had this desire to tell people to be careful because there's so many people who've come into crypto and haven't really experienced, you know, those days of exchanges just running away with money or absolutely bizarre stuff happening.
It's why I can literally only, like, if somebody wants to trade crypto derivatives, I can't recommend anything other than BitMEX.
Right. Just send them
just to because they've been here the longest. And
give
like,
them
I
your
trust
link.
Them. I think I've made $500 in 4 years. Roughly.
Oh, $500. I don't believe it. Actually, then again, you don't really shill your RefLink as much as some other big traders do.
And the thing is, like, the whole RefLink thing is kind of done. It's either you know a whale yourself and you convince him to use your RefLink by, like, just DMing him and stuff, or just you get, like, a guy who liquidates $10 and then that's it.
Right. I was joking with Romano a month ago that essentially, because he loves his ref links, and I kind of had a go at him about it. I'm like, hey man, you know, if you're so good at trading, why do you have these ref links all the time? And we were like, oh, it's because it's QE. It's QE for your, like, your leverage positions. you just have this margin, a little top up of margin coming every day, like lowering your liquidation price.
So I guess this kind of stems into the whole like passive income argument. Where like is it, if you're a profitable trader, is it all right to shill your ref link? And I think honestly it just comes down to personal preference. Like, there's something about money you don't get from directly trading that just makes you feel more secure.
Yeah, that's definitely fair. My personal opinion is, if you're referring to an exchange that you use and that you trust, I think that's fine. I think the problem becomes when you have people who are profitable traders and some dodgy exchange will be like, you know, we'll give you a heap of money if you start, you know, swap out all your ref links and tell everyone how great our exchange is. You don't have to trade with us. I think that's not really cool. Like, don't throw your followers under a bus.
I think that's a good point in that, where, so in crypto, we usually, like, we have stereotypes for everything and we usually base them off the worst case scenario. And in the case of ref links, it's where people are just like, you've got complete shitlords just spamming these scammy exchange ref links. They got paid 10k to shill.
Right.
And then we kind of take that as the norm because that's just the safest thing to do.
Yeah. Is there any recent new exchanges you've been trying in the derivatives space? I think kind of been the most excited about is FTX, just because of all their different products, like the leverage tokens in particular, I think are really interesting.
I can't really comment on leverage tokens since I've never really...
Oh, really?
Much.
Have you read about how they work, though, or...?
No.
I think a good place to start is if you read Romano's Medium post. They're actually quite good. Classic, typical blend of information and entertainment. But he really did a deep dive into how they work and explained their pros and cons. And he's been trading them a lot and finding them useful.
I think, regarding FTX, I think FTX is the worst UI I've ever seen. I like their ability to kind of roll out new products.
Do you know that, so FTX, their front end is just this open source Google Material UI toolkit thing. You can just download it as a web developer and plug it in to create a front end that works really well on desktop and mobile. They've obviously grabbed that so that they can quickly iterate. But I think they're working on a UI that they're building from scratch to replace everything with. It'll be interesting to see if that increases their volume or, you know, user growth. I think it will.
I think it definitely won't hurt.
The UI is the number one complaint I hear. Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any other exchanges that are really pushing out new stuff and testing new ideas.
I like Binance Futures in that you can kind of easily trade coins against each other. So, like, you can long on one contract and short on another.
The same,
I guess,
coin.
FTX also kind of fills that bucket. But I think the only reason I'd ever, like, actually trade on FTX is for the move contracts, which I think are amazing.
I like their spray and pray approach to product development. But that being said, one thing I've always wanted is, in the long term, how these exchanges that just do derivatives, FTX does spot as well, and they also have an OTC desk. But I think Binance is the really true one-stop shop. That's just super convenient. And I think as well, there's a lot of people who are obsessed with the Binance tokens. So that really locks users in, makes them quite sticky. And I don't see any other exchanges really getting that brand loyalty that Binance has. So in the long run, I think Binance is probably going just to become the absolute massive house of crypto, I think. It's very hard for people to compete.
Hit that destination. I mean, they have their own mining pool now.
The great thing about being across multiple parts of the industry is that you can offset losses in one area with profits from another. So, you know, they can just drop all their fees on derivatives to cut all the other derivatives exchanges out. And then when those other exchanges die or fade into oblivion, they can lift their fees again. Kind of like the Amazon approach, where you just sell everything and move money around to always offer the lowest price. And I think, unfortunately, like, you see this in other industries in the real world. Even if other exchanges do futures better than Binance or do spot better than Binance, because Binance is this one-stop shop that does everything above average, I guess. Not perfectly, but it's decent enough, then essentially all the smaller competitors just get squeezed out.
Yeah, that I mean, seems about right. You saw it with the Tezos staking, where people were offering, like, I think Coinbase was 20% fee, maybe. I'm not 100% on that. And then Binance just came in with, like, yeah, 0% staking fee. Come get it. And it kind of like destroyed the entire natural
Yeah.
market cycle of something like that.
You just
I mean, it
come in
was
with a slow
inevitable
channel.
that someone was going to offer 0%, but the fact it was just so instantaneous.
Yeah, but that's the beauty. They've got the power to do that. I think the famous Bezos line is your margin is my edge or something like that. As in like your any amount of profit you make, that's where I'm going to come in and eat your business alive. Do you trade any other, you said you didn't, you know, Bitcoin or Dogecoin specifically was the first thing you traded, but do you trade, are you trading stocks at the moment or currencies, anything else in traditional markets?
So I delved into equities a bit, but it was just
Where's the
yeah.
volatility? Where's the
Nah,
scams?
man, it was nah. It's just I can't fucking move money across my bank account to put into equities,
Right.
but we'll just pretend this part never happened.
Right.
Ah,
Is
it's
there
just there's like all my money's on fucking BitMEX.com, mate. What do you want from me? Has BitMEX got an SPX index?
No. It'll be interesting to see if there are some more crypto equity products eventually. I know FTX has got oil futures now, so they're kind of
The
hinting in that direction.
FTX oil futures are. I would. You'd have to shoot me to trade them.
Why?
I mean, you're putting up $100 of collateral for each barrel of oil. It's just.
Is that really how they work?
Yeah, so it's the price of oil plus $100.
Right.
So, like, if it ever goes negative, you're not screwed.
Okay.
But then it just means you're paying an extraordinary amount of fees.
Oh, because the fees charged on the value of the position.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But I think equities and based, like, crypto exchanges is kind of very worrying for me. Because it's gonna eventually end up where you have crypto. You have equities markets that trade 24/7, which I think would just be complete hell. Because it's already such a mental drain.
As in for people who are in the traditional finance space,
Yeah.
them adapting. Yeah. I, to be honest, over the past, you know, 8 years, whatever I've been interested in trading, I was never really into equities, or I wouldn't really look at them. I was, because I kind of had my economic philosophy, which is like this market's just going to go up at a steady rate because it's backed by all these Fed programs, and it's kind of like a social hazard for it to be allowed to fall. So it just, the equity market itself is too big to fail.
I mean, it's humanity where, like, if humans are doing good, the stock market should go up, and, like, nobody really wants it to go down.
Yeah, I think that is true. Like that has been, you know, the long-term justification for being long equities. Like you're long the global economy if you go long indexes, for example. But maybe historically that was true. You know, equities are directly tied to essentially economic growth or business growth specifically. And what we did then is we said, okay, well we're going to back people's retirements with equities. We're going to have sovereign wealth funds that fund all these programs and developments with equities essentially. My theory is that that's introduced a lot of moral hazard because people think that it's a two-way street. You know, if stocks are going up, then the economy must be growing. And there's so much pressure on upward stock growth because of all this money being funneled in through pension funds, like sometimes mandatory pension funds in a lot of countries, and all this money that goes into index funds, which just sprays capital across these corporations that don't necessarily deserve it. Stock valuations to revenue, really high levels. So I think it's kind of become a bit debased from reality because of the moral hazard that's introduced by almost mandatory money pushing in and then all this intervention from central banks and such. But that being said, if you did have a clean equity market that wasn't interfered with and people weren't forced to buy through pension funds and such, I'd love to see that. Yeah. I'm not against stocks or anything like that. I'm kind of against what it's become.
I think a way to combat that is just I've been delving into this idea and I think it's freaking amazing because I had it back when we nuked like the SPX hit its low. and stuff like Amazon was down a lot and other companies were down a lot. And I think just trading stocks against each other. So you say you'd long Amazon and short Boeing. And I think you've got really high EV opportunities there where you're also hedged against, say, like if the stock market goes up ballistic or it goes down ballistic, you're kind of, since you're long one equity and short another, you're still hedged against that.
Yeah. Well, I think I agree with that. I like that idea. I think in a efficient real market, there's going to be a need to sell. But, you know, if you think about it, like, say in Australia, every person with a full-time job, a certain percentage of their income gets pushed into the stock market by law. Some of your money goes to a pension fund, essentially, and they mandatorily have to buy certain percentages of different assets. So as long as Australians are working and getting paid, then there's a certain kind of money that's coming into stocks and pushing prices up. And that means that if you're trying to be a value investor and may come to an accurate stock price for a given company, you're competing with this mandatory buying. And then you're competing with all these weird injections that come in from central banks. And it's just very hard to do that. But, you know, if a company's not doing well, if it's not offering products that people like, if it's not treating its employees well and it's poorly managed, then it should go down. But there's this buy pressure, artificial buy pressure, that makes it hard for the market to react that way. Like you, crypto is the first thing I started trading. Even if you're not a free markets fanatic or anything like that, this is the way we've learned about how markets should work in a way. Crypto has kind of got this, it's quite big, but it's so unregulated. The characteristics of pricing are very free market. I think Peter Brandt, the charting guy on Twitter, says some stuff about this. That's why he's interested in crypto. The moves are very natural. I think for me personally, whenever I've gone to buy equities, just to invest in some indexes, thinking it's a good idea to diversify, honestly, I get intimidated by all the forms, all the strange arrangements, all the middlemen you have to deal with. I can't even get the information I need to really make sure that what I'm investing in is a good idea, or like the business is sound. There's just so much artificial trust involved, I guess. You're expected just to trust middlemen and whatever, and I don't for one second. I'm too jaded by being brought up during the global financial crisis.
I think it's a very good point in that how free and open crypto is, where it's very easy to get started. But I think it may be a bit too little too late with equities, but they've kind of started enabling more exposure to the everyday people through websites like Robinhood.
Yeah.
Have you seen Robinhood's just users holding for each stock? Like, their numbers have gone completely parabolic.
I've heard that, even with all the downtime and issues they've had, their user growth is really insane. Yeah. I guess on the flip side, what do you think of, you know, alternate investments? I guess CSGO skins is an obvious one, and then also Urbit usernames, things like that. Is there any other weird stuff you collect, either digital or even physical things?
I've always been a collector, but in the fact that, like, I enjoy looking at collections rather than collecting stuff myself.
Bit of an Antiques Roadshow fan.
Yeah. But I think there's the market for these kind of collectibles is only ever going to increase. Like, stuff like Magic the Gathering cards, for example, they've had a completely parabolic rise over the last few years.
Could you explain why this happens? Because, say, we're just joking about it, when I watch something like Antiques Roadshow, where does all the money come? Like, who's buying this stuff and why do they have so much money?
People just inherently love to collect. And just, I think there's a lot. It's, say, as a child, you just loved, like, this toy or something.
Right.
And then you grow up, you've got a good business, you're wealthy. It's nostalgia is an incredibly powerful, like, just genetic predisposition. Where we're naturally inclined to really want what we had in the past. Just because, say, like a couple thousand years ago, what was good in the past is probably going to be good now and, like, keep you alive and safe. And so this nostalgia just makes these ultra rich individuals be like, wow, I mean, I'm rich now, I can afford it. Let me just kind of buy back all I had back then and kind of like just use it to reminisce about the good old young days.
So is there kind of big collections you've got of interesting stuff, or are you just interested at the moment, thinking about it in future?
I'm just. It's sufficient for me to just watch YouTube videos of people's collections and stuff.
Right. I remember that kind of makes sense actually, because I remember we used to talk about watches a lot.
Ah, huge watch fan here.
What was that YouTube channel? We have to shout it out.
Archie Luxury. I don't think I could shout him out in good faith. He's either for his mental health or for the viewers. But he's an interesting fellow. He loves his watches. I think he recommended getting into credit card debt if you really wanted a watch, which I think is very astute advice.
I remember actually the first time I started messaging you, one of the first things you asked me was, "Oh, you're Australian?" And I said, "Yeah." And you go, "Do you know Archie Luxury? It's a big country, man." We don't all know each other. But is there anything else that you'd like to talk about? I've kind of gone through the things that I thought people would find interesting to know about you. But yeah, is there anything else?
I think that about covers everything.
Yeah, sweet. Well, thank you so much for being the first guest on the show, the first Zuma JD interview.
Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, well, I'd love to have you back if this show takes off, and maybe we'll see if people end up, if they find this interesting, if they have more questions for you. I think you're definitely one of the more interesting and talented people in the space. So thanks again, man.
Oh, thanks for having me.